So everybody who ordered a book thinks they've got it, or if you need a book and didn't order one, or you're not sure what you ordered, see Mildred. She'll take care of all that. And if you have any money, give it to Rochelle, because we ordered these books from our church, and she'll replenish the money. Because believe it or not, Rochelle takes care of money at our church. Y'all may not know that, but I don't want the money, because money and women get preachers in trouble. So I try to stay away from both. But no, I am very forgetful, and I can really, really use money quickly. Now, if you, let's see if I can do this. There we go. Now, we left off last week. I'd mentioned some things to you about the book of Nehemiah, and I've got all kinds of things on this table that I want to show you. So my approach after having talked to you last week is going to be less like I was teaching a college class and more like I was teaching Bible study at my church. And if that disappoints any of you, let me know. But if that doesn't disappoint you, that's kind of what I gathered last week we needed to do. So I went back home and I pulled some of the pictures I made. That doesn't show up good with this wall, does it? When I was in London at the British Museum, and this thing in the center of the wall there that looks kind of like an ear of corn, an oversized ear of corn, do you see that? This is called the Cyrus Cylinder. And King Cyrus, who gave the decree for Ezra and Nehemiah to begin the repopulation of Jerusalem, this is literally a decree that has been preserved by archaeology, and you can go there and see it. And it has written on it in the cuneiform language, which was the written language of ancient Babylon, what he did when he first became king. And this is one of the things he did. And so some of these things that to you and I from this distance look like a row of corn are actually a line of text that would tell us that what the Bible tells us he did. Now, for those of us who have faith, we don't need this proof, but this is an actual archaeological evidence of something in the Old Testament occurring outside of our chain of evidence of our faith history. So this is one of the benefits for archaeology for us as we try to do what we call in evangelism apologetics, which is to defend the faith. So that's in the museum, the British Museum in London. If you ever get the opportunity to go there, I recommend you do so. It's a wonderful thing to behold. And I'm going to show you some other things from there. But if you do go, if you get the opportunity to go, don't do it in an afternoon. You need to, it's kind of like going to our Smithsonian. You need a week at least to begin to do anything. Now, these are just some other artifacts that come from ancient Assyria. And last week I began by talking about the history behind this, that you had the Assyrian kingdom take the 10 northern tribes into captivity. These are things that come from Assyria, okay? And these are just some basic relics that are there. These are called Lamassu. And these would be in the temples and in the important chambers that you would go into. These are winged beings, have the face of a man, the body of a bull, and then wings. And they're put together in such a way, these are actually, this comes from the New York Met, not in London, but there's some more of those there. This is a picture of one. This one's from London, and it actually stood in Sennacherib, and we find him in the Bible, actually stood in his palace, this one. It's where they found it, and they know that. And this is what they were made so as to look like they were walking no matter where you viewed them. So if you view it head on, it looks like it's walking. If you view it from the side, it looks like it's walking. And the whole point of that is, you see, these people were idol worshipers, and anything that they could do to make the idol appear to have life made the idol more powerful. And aren't you glad that we don't have to fake it to make our God appear more powerful? And this is just evidence of another one. And see how, if you look at it, it appears to be standing, but from the side you can see how they made the feet so that it appears it's walking. Now, this is another thing I just wanted to show you as we started today. This is called the Rosetta Stone. Anybody ever hear a commercial about the Rosetta Stone? There's this language program that you can get on your computer that will teach you different languages. It's called the Rosetta Stone. Well, this is the actual Rosetta Stone, and it's in London. And this was found by Napoleon's soldiers when they were in Egypt. And you have here hieroglyphics, ancient Greek, and the language of Egypt, Eptoptic. Okay? Now, what this did for us is, because it had ancient Greek on it, and we know ancient Greek because the Bible is in ancient Greek, we were able to translate these hieroglyphics, and the Rosetta Stone came to be a way that we could understand what they found in the hieroglyphics in Egypt. So this is a very key piece of evidence for us in languages. Now, the reason I wanted to start there, this is the Hebrew Bible, okay? This is the Bible in the Old Testament. All this is the Old Testament in the language of Hebrew. You open it not like this. This is the back of the book. This is the front of the book because it goes backwards for us, okay? So this is Genesis. And the reason I'm just wanting to show you, Ezra and Nehemiah are not where we have them in our Bible, okay? They're in the back. What we call 1st and 2nd Chronicles, which we believe were written by Ezra, they're the last books in this Bible, okay? Because they have them recorded as they think they were written in chronological order by writing. The book of 1st and 2nd Kings, which for us is right next to 1st and 2nd Chronicles, it's kind of in the middle here. Well, actually, that's 2 Kings. I just happened to open to it. Okay? So, Ezra and Nehemiah, this is the beginning of, actually, the beginning of Ezra. And if you can see, it says Ezra and Nehemiah here. Because remember I told you last week, they're one book in this. We're studying Nehemiah, which is actually the second half of the book of Ezra, Nehemiah. Okay? And then after Nehemiah, we have the book of... Let me see if I can find where it actually starts here. We have the book of 1st and 2nd Chronicles. We believe that Ezra, yeah, and I don't know if you can see, this is Ezra, and then there's Nehemiah, and all that changes is the numbering. They're one book. So I just wanted to let you know I wasn't lying, because it's very different than what we have in our Bible. Now, if you're going to study the book, and I want to make sure, I have here with me a Thompson Chain reference, Dave Criswell's study Bible, a Life Application Bible. The Open Bible. Who has another Bible, another study Bible with them? Life Application? Nelson's, okay. Anybody else have another study Bible? The reason I share that with you, if you will, what I wanted to do, I'm showing you the outline, but I want to show you how you can find outlines. Now, in the Thompson Chain reference, it's a little different. The Life Application and some of the other Bibles, they have the outline in the front before you get to Nehemiah chapter 1. Well, the Thompson Chain reference, it has all that stuff in the back. And I apologize. These are copies. I've preached out of these Bibles and, tore this one to pieces. This was the 21st birthday present. My mother and dad gave me, and I started preaching when I was 18, and I've devoured it. I actually thought I was onto something. I started reading this Bible, and I underlined different things in different colors. If it had anything to do with persecution. I underlined it in green. Had something to do with salvation. Underlined that in red. Had something to do with heaven. Underlined that in blue. Had something to do with sin. Underlined that in black. And I did that through this whole Bible. And then about a year later, they came out with this thing called the Rainbow Study Bible. So as usual, I was a day late and a dollar short. Yep. But the book of Nehemiah is, if you have a Thompson Chain reference at home, just write down this 4238. That's the number in the back that you can go find the book of the outline for there. Yes? You were going to ask something? No? Okay, all right. And according to this, it says, it tells us that in the Hebrew manuscripts, the books of Ezra and Nehemiah appear as one book, which we saw. And it tells us that the key text is Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 3. So if you have your Bible, turn to Nehemiah 6, verse 3, and let's just see what, according to the Thompson Chain reference, because we're going to see these various study Bibles tell us a few different things. And also, Esther is after Nehemiah in our Bible. It's before Ezra and Nehemiah in the Hebrew Bible. So in Nehemiah 6, verse 3, now I'm reading out of the I think this is NASB. That's what I picked up. It says, "So I sent messengers to them saying, I am doing a great work and cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you?" Okay, now according to the Thompson Chain reference, the whole book of Nehemiah is about the work, how important the work is. We've got to keep doing, okay? Can't stop. Now, if you look at, this is the Life Application Bible, and you look, it has in the front of it, you know, before you get to the actual text of Nehemiah, it'll have the outline and some other interesting information for you. And according to it, let's see, what's the key verse is chapter 6 also, but verse 15 and 16. So the wall was finished in the 25th day of the month, Elul, in 52 days. And it came to pass that when all our enemies heard thereof, and all the heathen that were about us saw these things, they were much cast down in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was wrought of our God. Okay? Now, I actually think that they're closer to the mark because I think that's the key. Because remember, I said Ezra and Nehemiah go together. And I showed you last week, I don't know if you remember, I could scroll back here a few slides and find it for you, out of Ezra, that how the hand of God was on Ezra to prosper him, the hand of God was on Ezra to prosper him. And that's the idea. That important, the work is important, but in the Bible, who gets credit? God. Nehemiah and Ezra were used by God to do this work, and you have this wonderful list of everybody who did this work, but God should get the credit for it, right? And we do this still, do we not, in our churches? We have things given in memory, we have plaques on it, or we have a book somewhere that'll tell you who did what when things were built. We still do that kind of thing, but we don't, in doing that, I hope, we're not taking the credit. We're not saying that these people did it. We're saying that these people were used by God as He did it. Now, this other Bible I'm going to read from, this is the Criswell Study Bible. Does everybody know who Dr. Criswell was? Dr. W.A. Criswell, one of the great preachers. More than that, he actually started a wonderful college, the Criswell School out in Dallas. And one of my professors, the gentleman who taught me New Testament Greek, and then a theology professor I had, both were graduates of that school. Now, according to Dr. Criswell, he says the theme of Nehemiah, and he doesn't really give us a key verse as the others do, but he does think that the theme, the period, is that God would use people to do a great work, and that with God, there's nothing that cannot be accomplished. So he's more interested in chapter 2 and points us there to the work being done. And we'll get there later. But I just wanted to show you, I've got three different study Bibles. that give us three different ideas of what is key. So if you read a Bible, when you pick it up and begin to read, if you get a study Bible, remember those are like commentaries. But it's a great way to study. Now, how many of you have what's called a Bible dictionary at home? Okay. These are things that you can probably get today, I don't know, 10, 20 bucks. Not an expensive thing. If you're going to be a serious student, and I've got another one here holding up our projector. I'm sorry. Yeah, the Holman's. If you pay attention, sometimes you can go to Lifeway and get one of these things on sale. You know, that they've marked it down. But this is an old one, the Nelson's Bible Illustrated. And Nelson's is a great publishing company, and it's someone you can trust. If you see something was published by Nelson, that's good. The Open Bible that I have here, that is actually the first Bible I ever had, and it shows kind of. But this is published by Nelson, and it's still a good Bible. But in this dictionary, it talks about Nehemiah and the book of Nehemiah and gives you some background, and probably in maybe a page and a half. And this yellow box is the outline there, okay? Just wanting to show, if you want to study something, you know, there are a lot of ways that you can do that without having to depend on someone telling you something. Now, there's also a lot of wonderful things now on the internet, but be careful when you get stuff off the internet. There's a lot of good stuff on the internet, and there's also a lot of junk on the internet. And anyone can write something and put it on the internet, and it all looks equal. So be very careful on the internet, because you can get some really great things and you can get some really bad things. Now, this is the big outline view, and then we're going to get smaller. But as we talk about Nehemiah, there's two halves to it. Nehemiah, the first half, chapter 1 through chapter 7, okay? And that's all the stories about rebuilding the wall. And it talks about his arrival and talks about the restoration of the wall and the responsibility that it entails. And then the second half is all about the reforms of how they worshiped. Okay? The reforms of how they worshiped. And as we look at this, I want you to think about, there's so much from Nehemiah that we still do. The book of Nehemiah, probably more than any other book in the Bible, informs how you and I worship on Sunday morning. Probably Nehemiah would be number one, I would say, and the Psalms number two. Because so much of our worship, our praying, our singing is directly related to Psalms. But the idea of having a covenant, we have covenants together. The idea of listing, you know, keeping up with, knowing who did something. The identification of who's a priest, who's a Levite, you know, who's a preacher, who's a deacon, those, you know, knowing who's doing what. Dedicating something after you build it. You ever build a building and not dedicate it? We don't do that. But you know, in seminary, they don't teach you how to have a dedication service. Don't ever talk about that. We get all that straight out of Nehemiah. And then look at this, priests, Levites, singers, porters, and methods of support. Well, the only other place that you see anything talking about how people are supported is the law, and then some of the writings of the New Testament by Paul. But Nehemiah talks about that. And then singers, the idea of having song in worship, having a group of people sing that we would call a choir. All that's Nehemiah. The idea for evangelism of exclusivity comes out of Nehemiah. The prohibition against intermarriage with the Ammonites and the Moabites. Which we're glad that Boaz didn't listen to Nehemiah, aren't we? Because Ruth, in the descendants of King David and of Jesus, was a Moabitess. Right? And then Nehemiah coming back again as governor. So those are the broad ideas, and then we're going to just talk about them a little more. So this is a more outline, specific. So if you have your Bible, let's go ahead and start. Did we identify that everybody, pretty much, most people in the room have a King James Version or an NIV? Which was it last week? I don't remember. Okay, if you got a King James, raise your hand. Let me do a quick inventory. 3, 4. New King James, okay. If you got an NIV, raise your hand real quick. 1, 2, 3, 4. So we're split down the middle. 5. Okay. At Emerson, when they built the building there, which was before I got there, they bought Pew Bibles and their NIV version. So that's kind of what I use the most. But I don't have it. Of all the versions I have with me today, I don't have an NIV. I have an ESV, an NASB, a King James. But I got a lot of King James up here. So I think I will just read out of the NASB and make no one happy. So Nehemiah chapter 1, let's look at chapter 1, verse 1 through 3. The words of Nehemiah, the son of... Now, how do you say that? Can I teach you a little Hebrew? I mean, I don't mean to... I'm not trying to show out or anything, but in Hebrew, you're not going to have two consonants together in the same syllable. Okay? So, where you see that you have the H-A-C, so ha, and then the C-A-L, that's a syllable, and the I-A-H. So it's ha-kala. That's three syllables. Because you're just not going to have... You know what our vowels are. Now in Hebrew, if you were reading this in the Hebrew Bible, there are no vowels in it, which makes it really confusing. If you don't, you have to do a lot of study to figure out what goes where. Okay? They didn't have them. So the words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakali, now it happened in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, while I was in Susa, the capital, that Hanani, one of my brothers and some men from Judah came, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped and had survived the captivity and about Jerusalem. And they said to me, the remnant there in the province who survived the captivity are in great distress and reproach, and the wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are burned with fire. So the news from Jerusalem is it's bad. It's bad. But notice, and this is important for us, even after the terrible Babylonian captivity, there's still a remnant in Jerusalem. And that's important for our theology. God always leaves a remnant. And if you want to think about how bad it could get, go and read Lamentations of Jeremiah. That's not a pleasant book to read, is it? You've ever read the Lamentations of Jeremiah? That is a book that makes you sick to your stomach to read when you consider the horror and the terror that was happening. And that's why we call Jeremiah the weeping prophet, because of the book of Lamentations. So the news is bad. So what does Nehemiah do? Now what do when we get bad news sometimes? Sometimes we say, well, that's tough, isn't it? And going about our proverbial rat killing, do nothing. Sometimes we gossip about it. Hey, have you heard? Right? But Nehemiah does neither of those things. He does what we should do. He starts praying. So look at what he does. He's very concerned, and his concern leads him to prayer, and his prayer leads him to action. Now, it came about when I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days. Don't know if Ann's still here or not. I wept and I mourned for days. Do we, when we hear bad news, how does it affect us? And if something affected someone where they wept and mourned for days, what would we say? That this person had what kind of heart? What? a tender heart, a sensitive heart, and a broken heart. Okay? And if you hear bad news and it doesn't affect you, we say we have what kind of heart? Cold heart or a hard heart. Right? Okay? So Nehemiah, there's nothing wrong with his heart. He is open to God. So we keep reading. And I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. Now, so he cries for days, and we do a lot of that. And you read the Psalms, and David does a lot of that. And sometimes we get biblical and we pray that prayer of complaint, right? But his broken heart leads him to something that I think sometimes is missing from our churches today, prayer and fasting. And so Nehemiah, his concern, his burden, we would say. You ever hear anybody talk about somebody being burdened? Okay. His burden leads him to prayer and fasting. And in prayer, I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. So right here is evidence, biblical evidence of fasting. We don't find much fasting in the New Testament. Why?
Why do we not practice fasting in the New Testament?
Because we believe in the full gospel. Yeah, you sound like, have you been listening to my sermons? I believe that we need to. As a matter of fact, next Sunday across the Georgia Baptist Convention, many churches, ours isn't going to do it this Sunday, we're going to do it the next Sunday, we are supposed to be declaring a solemn assembly and coming before God in prayer and fasting and confession. I think we have confused, Jesus says in the New Testament that we don't fast the bride while the bridegroom's with you. You don't fast. And so the apostles didn't really fast, and it's not written much of. And we've kind of taken that. And also I think we don't fast because we like to eat. And we have equated fellowship with eating in the Baptist church. You know, you know that joke? You've probably heard your preacher tell you this, that three little boys go to school for show and tell. The Jewish boy they're told to bring a sign of their faith. And the Jewish boy brings a menorah as a sign of his Jewish faith. And the Catholic boy brings a crucifix as a sign of his Jewish faith. And the little Baptist boy brings a casserole dish as a sign of his Baptist faith. And we have really equated in our churches fellowship with eating. And we have indulged. So that's part of it. Then there's also in our culture, we're in a time, or have been up until the economy diving, of great plenty. And in times of plenty, we overeat. And because of that, we don't fast. So I think it's twofold. But I think it's a need. And that's why I wanted to point out, Nehemiah's concern, his burden for Jerusalem, leads him to prayer and fasting. Now, the corollary of that in the New Testament for you and I, our burden for lost people should lead us to prayer and fasting. Our burden for missions, if we have a true burden that the world be reached for Christ, that should lead us to prayer and fasting. If we have a burden that our churches need revival, that should lead us to prayer and fasting. And if you look at the history of the church, we take examples out of the Bible like Nehemiah, and great men and women of faith in the past have been led by this example and others to prayer and fasting. And God always responds. Because remember, Jesus says, this kind leadeth, cometh out only except through prayer and fasting in Mark. We'll get to Mark a little later. Now, so Nehemiah's concern leads him to prayer and fasting. And if you keep looking at through verse 11, so here's what he prays. And I said, I beseech thee, O Lord, God of heaven, the great and awesome God who preserves the covenant and loving kindness for those who love him and keep his commandments, let thine ear now be attentive and thine eyes open to hear the prayer of thy servant, which I am praying before thee now. Now, how many of you have had the course Disciples Prayer Life? Is that something y'all have ever studied together? Well, that might be something, Miss Mildred, down the road. It's a wonderful study on prayer. It's a 13-week course, one of those life courses. It's a great study. And in it gives us a principle. if we're going to pray as a Christian, one of the things we need to do is to give God a reason to answer our prayer. And you can only pray to God if you're His child. And notice what Nehemiah is doing here. He's giving God that reason. He's saying, I beseech Thee, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who preserves the covenant and loving kindness for those who love Him and keep His commandments. So he is reminding God of His covenant that He has made with His people Israel. Okay, so we would call that in that course, giving God a reason. He goes on to say, let thine ears be attentive and thine eyes open to hear the prayer of thy servant, which I am praying before thee now, day and night, on behalf of the sons of Israel, thy servants. So he continues to give him evidence that I am your son, I am living with you, I am in covenant with you. And then he turns to confession, which is always an important part of our prayers. Confessing the sins of the sons of Israel, which we have sinned against thee, I and my father's house have sinned. Now, before we go further there, look what he does. He's confessing not only his own sin, but he's confessing the sins of his brothers. So this idea of having a day of solemn assembly, a day of coming before God and confessing, it's not just confessing your own individual sins, but you and I in our churches, we're guilty of what's called corporate sins. Okay? Now, we always confess sins of what? There are two kinds of sins we confess. Sins of omission and sins of commission. But as a church, as individuals who have covenanted together, we have sins of both commission and omission. And so times of solemn assembly, which, guess where you get the example of that? In the latter half of Nehemiah, they call together. Okay? So this idea comes straight out of this book that we're studying. And he confesses both his sin and the sins of his brothers. So he's confessing his own private sin, his own personal sin, but also the corporate sin of others. And then he goes on and gets specific. Verse 7, we have acted very corruptly against thee and have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, nor the ordinances which thou didst command thy servant Moses. So he's getting specific. Commandments, statutes, and ordinances. So he's covering the whole gamut of what we would call the Torah or the law. Okay. He goes on to say, remember the word which thou didst command thy servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though those of you who have been scattered were in the most remote part of heavens, I will gather them from there and will bring them to the place where I have chosen to cause my name to dwell. So he's reminding God of his promise. And there, if we want to pray for revival, this is a great application for us in praying for revival. He's confessing what he's done, but he's reminding God of his promise. Now, do we think about this? How often do we remind God of his promise as we finish this idea of what you pray for? So in his prayer, he's confessing both his sin and the sins of others, the corporate sins, private sins, and corporate sins. He is confessing that they have messed up, that they've acted corruptly. Now, that's a very strong word, corrupt. You can go to jail if you're corrupt, right? You do hard time if you are corrupt. So he's not holding anything back. And sometimes, are we not guilty of holding things back? We want him to do a partial confession, not the whole. He's going the whole way here. Okay? And that's important because later what you see God do in the eyes of the opposition is going to be how powerful God will react on behalf of Nehemiah is because of Nehemiah's character himself. And this is giving us great insight into his personal character. So if you want to expect great things from God and do great things for God. And who said that? Y'all know that quote? WMU ladies? William Carey. That was for his call to missions that began what is known today as the modern mission movement. attempt great things for our God, expect great things from God. So if you're going to do that, if you're, in other words, you're going to put your faith to the test, you got to have personal character, great personal character. You can't be holding back in your confession. And Nehemiah doesn't. Now, he goes on to say, to the place where I have chosen to cause my name to dwell. Now, he is telling God in that for his glory. He's saying, Lord, do this for your glory, not for us. The place where you said you cause your name to dwell. And that's the test. We start doing things for our own sake so that people will know how good we are, we're really getting in trouble. The place where you cause your name to dwell. And then he says in verse 10, and they are thy servants and thy people whom thou didst redeem by thy great power and by thy strong hand. He is beginning to recite back to God what are known in the Old Testament as the mighty acts of God. Okay? Thou didst redeem them by thy great power, by thy strong hand. That's why it's so important for you to know the book of Exodus. Okay? The book of Exodus is really important as you go through the rest of the prophets because it's always referred back to. And the great and mighty deeds that God does, that His strong hand, I mean, it's His hand that saves them from Pharaoh. It's His hand, remember, He hardens the heart of Pharaoh. He is seen as in absolute control over the whole situation. And Exodus shows us God is in charge of the sea. He's in charge of the land. He's in charge of their food. He's in charge of Joshua, the son. I mean, the whole idea of the Exodus, that they're going from Egypt and that they're taking the land, God is sovereign over everything. There's not any one aspect of anything He can't control. And He's reminding him of that. O Lord, I beseech Thee, may Thine ear be attentive to the prayer of Thy servant and the prayer of Thy servants who delight to revere Thy name, and make Thy servant successful today, and grant him compassion before this man. Now I was the cupbearer to the king. So he prays all that, and we get to see his heart before he ever goes to talk to the king. And isn't that backwards to how we usually do it? We go do things that God has, and then we have to pray, Lord, would You help me get out of this that I started now? What? Yeah, that's. But Nehemiah, he prays first. But actually, before the prayer was the great burden. Praying, fasting, mourning for days. But we don't do anything for days, do we? No, we don't. We don't. Yes, yes, and I am living evidence. I tell the church, and of course, much of my weight is absolutely Rochelle and well, Madge. Well, both of them are guilty, and others. They're not the only ones. Of course, nobody forced me. I've been shoveling in. But I have never been a part of a church that ate as much as First Baptist Church of Emerson. When I got there, and we don't eat as much as we used to, but when I first got there, man, they ate a lot. And I've gained, I think, 45 pounds since I became their pastor. That's in 5 years. And of course, like I said, nobody put a gun to my head. But the chicken and dressing and the cake and the pie and the good food, I just have shoveled it down. Now, the reason I say that, though, is I want you to think about it. We rush into serving God, do we not? We don't take time to weep. We don't take time to pray. We rush. We think it, and we think, well, God must be in it. I thought it, and off we go. And that is so contrary to the example of Nehemiah. He wept for days. If you weep for days in our culture, well, you're depressed and we go get you on Zoloft. Right? See, I mean, God used this guy's depression. And what kind of man goes around weeping for days? I mean, this is not a manly man. We would be thinking something wrong with him. Doesn't fit our profile. And then his prayer reveals that he's very sensitive. So I just want you to see that as we think about it. Now, what do you get out of the first chapter of Nehemiah?
The situation.
Yeah. And it's important, I think. 2 Chronicles 7:14, the verse you're quoting, and of course it occurs in other places, but 2 Chronicles was written by Ezra. And so that whole concept of what we see as revival, and because we mistakenly put Chronicles with Kings, we think about it being Solomon, but it's Ezra who's recording that prayer. And so they're giving us evidence of how they saw God act through revival. And Ezra's also humbled himself, and the hand of God was upon him. And what you really have in Ezra and Nehemiah is the first record of what you and I would call a revival. Okay? Written by the people who were there. Jonathan Edwards wrote about the Great Awakening. Ezra and Nehemiah is that kind of book. And it's really valuable to us. And we, as a church, we dismiss it. We don't talk. I mean, when's the last time you heard a sermon on Nehemiah or a sermon on Ezra? We miss it. Because we don't. And if we have a sermon on Nehemiah, as we talked about last week, it's about leadership. You know, the leadership principles. And we kind of miss the context. You're seeing about revival. And one of the reasons we don't talk about it is because we don't want to have to talk about all the... There's a lot of bad stuff about divorce in Ezra and Nehemiah, you know. And preachers don't want to have to deal with that. So, but it's really there. I wanted to show you... this is just some text I've got in my computer here from Nehemiah. He's asked God, let your ear now be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant, which I am praying before you now. Do you see that he is not taking for granted that God would listen to him? And I don't want you to miss that. I think we are really, and please don't misunderstand, I believe we should be bold before the throne of grace. But I also think sometimes we come off as spoiled brats in our praying. You ever see a little kid demanding that he get his way from his mama in the grocery store? Right? If you listen to the heart of Nehemiah as he prays this prayer, this is not a spoiled brat. He's got a genuine broken heart. And as he prays, he is not assuming that because he is God's servant, that God will automatically hear him. There is true reverence in this prayer. He understands that God is up here and he is down here. I mean, you see that and you hear it. Now, he's not so meek that he won't ask, and we shouldn't be, but in his prayer, there's true, genuine humility in this prayer. And the Bible tells us in many places that God's looking for what? That contrite spirit, the contrite man. And you see, this is one of the best examples, I think, in the Bible of that. This prayer of Nehemiah. Now, I wanted to show you something that actually what I'm doing with this document. Strategy coordinator. Today at Tabernacle, the Bartow Baptist Association is hosting a thing called the Great Commission Initiative. And this is the third or fourth time that they've been here doing this. And there's a man there who's one of our foreign missionaries, who's just a wonderful person who's teaching it. And we got a couple. Actually, my youngest son is there today taking it, and I've taken it. But the North American Mission Board and the International Mission Board, which I still want to call the Home Mission Board and the Foreign Mission Board, that, you know, that's wrong. That's the improper way to say it today. But this idea of a strategy coordinator. What we're looking for and what they're going to begin to promote, and you're going to begin to hear about this and read about this, are individuals in churches who will accept the responsibility for being trained and beginning the work of being a strategy coordinator to work with a people group, that's an ethno-linguistic people group, a group of people who share the same heart language, who are unreached by the gospel. Now, as the strategy coordinator, that doesn't say you're going to be the missionary and you're going to go do the reaching, but it does say you're going to begin heading up that the reaching gets done and begin to coordinate that and set strategy. And the book of Nehemiah is given to us in that training as one of the best examples of Nehemiah being a strategy coordinator. And so the reason I share this with you is I want you to see there's so many different layers and levels and ways you can look at Nehemiah. It is just such a rich book. And if you look at this first characteristic over here, Nehemiah is concerned with and interested in the welfare of others. Now, please, I'm working on this as something I'm going to write to give those guys to use in their training. So this is me talking now, not doesn't have the authority of somebody who really knows what he's talking about. Okay, Nehemiah, and that's what I get out of this, that he hears this word and he's concerned with it and he's interested in the welfare of others. And that's the heart of being a strategy coordinator or being a missionary or being a Christian, having that burden for lost people, that burden for lostness that causes you to want to do something about it. And then the second characteristic that I have here, is Nehemiah has a sensitive heart. His heart is not callous, but affected by the conditions of those in his people group. So, and I think sometimes we've gotten calloused. We see lost folks as deserving what they get. Right? It's easy for us to do that. I think sometimes it's easier to be caring about somebody you don't know, somebody who's far away, than it is sometimes somebody you do know. So, all right, I have that it's 250, and based on what I saw last week about how much time it took, I'm planning on kind of stopping now and then letting us break, and then we'll come back tomorrow. So if you got any questions about Nehemiah, anything that you've discovered, anything to add, please let me know. Tell me now. Anybody? Lee, tell them where you've been going on the web so they might go to Stedman.
Ray Stedman?
Yeah.
Let me read you a quote.
Go for it.
On the book of
Nehemiah.
It says, the book of Nehemiah
hadn't been written. Yeah, he's solid. Ray used to be on Charles Swindoll's staff, and he's solid. But pbc.org, and the name is Ray Stedman.
Stedman,
right? Okay. And Ray, he's got sermons, because he's got a lot of stuff on Nehemiah, and the stuff Lee has, I think, is actually probably a sermon series he did on Nehemiah. But you can also get anything. I mean, he's got other things. It's not just something on the book of Nehemiah. He's got a lot. That's a great website, a great resource for you.
Yeah, I've downloaded the whole book of Nehemiah that he preached the whole book of Nehemiah.
Right. That's great. And that's what's in that notebook? That's what's in your notebook there? Okay, well, I might steal that later. All right. Anybody else have anything? Well, the refreshments are back there. Before we have them, I want to ask you to, let's pray, and I want to give you a prayer request. There's a lady in our church named Yvonne Alcantara, Y-V-O-N-N-E, and her last name is spelled A-L-C-A-N-T-R-A. Who has been diagnosed with a recurrence of cancer. She had a third of her tongue removed the last time she had this, and there is now a lump on the side of her throat here. And she goes in the hospital at Kennesaw on Friday of this week to have that removed, and then she's going to begin another course of chemo and radiation again. And if you would be put her on your personal prayer list, and if you would share her name with your church's prayer list, we would be most appreciative of that. Yvonne's a very special lady, does a lot of work in our church, and just she's a lot of fun to talk to. Neat lady. And we really need you to be praying for her, and anybody you know who does pray, if you would give them her name, we would appreciate it. I sure will. It is